are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Today's sponsor of the program is Casper Mattresses. Casper has sponsored this program in the past. They are American-made mattresses, and they're sold at a shockingly reasonable price. You can get $50 off of any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority using the coupon code majority. And here's the amazing thing about Casper. Not only do they deliver the mattress to your house, which is a huge pain. I mean, I don't know how people get it to their houses otherwise. One time, Nikki and I have to say, we put a mattress on the top of our car that we bought in New Jersey. And it was, I can only tell you what a huge nightmare it was. No one, fortunately, there was no car accidents and no one passed away. But it was literally the last time I said, we're never, ever doing anything like this again. Well, Casper delivers it right to your house. And then this is the thing that's really amazing about them. You try it for 100 days, over 3 months. If you're not happy, they pick it back up. It's $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size mattress. You get $50 off by going to casper.com/majority using the coupon code majority. Check it out right now. Of course, all our information about sponsors at the... on the majority.fm.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, June 16th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, NYU Professor Kristen Ross on communal luxury, the political imaginary of the Paris Commune. Yes, folks, we're going back to the 1800s for this one. But also on the show, in this century, Donald Trump announces he will be running for president. And in the spirit of Donald Trump, I will say, I told you that he was going to run. I will be incredibly arrogant in talking about Donald Trump as an homage to perhaps the most serious candidate in the Republican presidential field. Also on the program today, George Bush announced, or Jeb Bush, one of the Bushes, announced yesterday. Ted Cruz whines, you just don't understand how hard it is to run for president. Please give me money. Also on the program, the IMF. Pay low-income people more money to help economies. TPP, not dead yet. Not dead yet, but maybe dead. We will discuss the fallout from the big vote last Friday. And white nationalists take to Indiegogo to raise money for a white nationalist enclave. Did I mention that Donald Trump announced he will be running for president?
We are pumped here.
Oh, the Pope also, his encyclical was leaked. It predicted that Donald Trump would be running for president. And Be prepared for the libertarian blowback on this one, folks. EPA puts out rules saying that companies can no longer put plastic in their food starting 3 years out from now. Trans fats will be banned.
More freedoms.
Yes, I know. I know. We are not free. We're living in an unfree era, ladies and gentlemen. We will get to the Donald Trump stuff. And look, I've been saying this for months that I think he was going to jump in this time around, largely because there's so many other people running that he can't lose. He will just be one of 10 guys who don't win, or 15 guys who don't win, or literally 19 guys who don't win. But let's be honest. I want to know what of his positions are really outside of mainstream Republican thought. His xenophobia, his idea about building the walls, his irrational sort of convoluted fears of China, harping on the Affordable Care Act website, talking about Benghazi, birtherism. What is it about Donald Trump that really is fundamentally different from anybody else in the Republican Party? I mean, if Donald Trump lived in Wisconsin, he'd be Ron Johnson, just without charisma. So, and he very well may be more sophisticated than Ron Johnson. I mean, let's be honest, folks. And in terms of polling, he's going to do as well as three quarters of the field. Better than. We're going to see him. Carly Fiorina? I mean, is Donald Trump really any more ludicrous of a candidate than Carly Fiorina or Ben Carson?
Less.
Or, I mean, honestly. So we're going to cover him and we're going to enjoy it. Folks, one other note, quickly. I asked the Credo folks for a couple more days. We had people who had emailed in and said that they couldn't make the decision yet. Is there any chance that I could give them an extension? And I was like, well, let me just go to the Credo folks. We have an extension now on the Credo deal until Thursday. It will be done on Thursday. We sent out an email about an hour ago when we got the okay. Credo is America's only progressive phone company. They're given a deal for Majority Report listeners right now. You go to credomobile.com/majority report. You get $100 off any new phone, 25% off your data fees for the first year. If you have a pre-existing contract, they will give you a credit on your Credo bill up to $350 to pay your way out of that contract. You can try and turn in your existing phone. They give up to $300 for some models of phones. It is, and you know what Credo does. They fought. They were one, it was The Hill that wrote that piece. They were one of five or six organizations cited in pieces that stopped the TPP. They're a fantastic organization. Check out credomobile.com/majority report right now. Check it out. Noodle around it. If you call in, call them at 800-966-1665. Mention offer code 501-882. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Kristen Ross about that 70-day period in the 1870s where Paris was run as a massive commune. We'll be right back after this.
The flames grow higher.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Comparative Literature at NYU, Kristen Ross, on her latest book, Communal Luxury, The Political Imaginary of the Paris Commune. Welcome to the program, Kristen.
Thank you.
So, for those people who do not know, and I know there's been a lot of history books written about this very brief period of time in 1871 in Paris, but for those people who don't know about the Paris Commune, can you just give us a sense of it in its, I guess, its narrowest sense? Because I know your book basically covers the sort of the ideas that led up to that before and after, or emanated out of it. But give us the sort of the more practical understanding of it, just so that we're all on the same page here.
So sort of the bare bones of what happened?
Yes, please.
Okay, so the French government had bungled a war, a very ill-conceived war with the Prussians. And in the wake of that, the working class in Paris had been armed because of this war. And when France gave in to the Prussians, caved in really, they sent the army to take possession of the guns that the working class had. They were frightened that the workers were armed.
And we should say Paris at this point was no longer the capital of France.
Well, somewhat, yes, but it was still in a sense the capital. It was, and what had happened was that the wealthiest people had already fled the city because they were frightened of revolution, and the army, the government bungled its attempt to seize the guns, and they were forced to withdraw. So essentially, the government withdrew. The state actually left the city, and the city was left with no officials, no functionaries, no police, no magistrates. It was an incredible opportunity in a sense, and the working class took advantage of it. They began to lead their own lives, and for 72 days they did so. They organized and managed their own life according to their principles of association, of cooperation, of mutual aid, and they did this for 72 days until the French state revamped itself and came in and essentially attempted to massacre everyone in the city.
And they ended up killing somewhere between 15 and 25,000 people, is that right?
Yes. I mean, the numbers are constantly being disputed, but that's about the one that stands.
And so, I mean, how many, give us a sense, I mean, and obviously, I mean, I think this you are revisiting this period because in many respects, the idea of protest and of occupying space in has, well, at least, for a while, came back into fashion in around the world a couple of years ago. And in many respects, we're still sort of living in that in the wake of that new era. But give us a sense of like how this actually worked. I mean, we don't, 1870, we don't, or 1871, we don't have the technologies, obviously, that we have today, how quickly were things put into place? Did people actually experience these things? And what were these things?
Well, you know, they only had 72 days, and yet they did an amazing amount of things that we can see, tangible, you know, living examples of what lives look like when they're really emancipating themselves, you know, when they are going about the whole process of essentially dismantling a state apparatus. You know, Marx said that the communards smashed the state, and I think that's not quite right. I think that what I see more is a kind of a step-by-step dismantling of state bureaucracy in an incredibly short bit of time. And so this is why, this is the significance of the commune, that it's an example, an incredible example of lives led differently and outside of the path that was subsequently taken by, say, capitalist modernization on the one hand, or, you know, the kind of erecting of state managed socialism on the other. This was something very different. That's why when Marx says what was valuable about the commune was their own working existence, not any laws they passed or any, you know, anything that they managed to enact precisely, but simply that they existed with all of the contradictions, all of the limitations included. So, for example, the first thing they did was welcome all foreigners into the commune. They enacted a complete separation of church and state. They dragged guillotines out into the square and burnt them. They closed down pawn shops. They demolished the Vendome Column, which was the incredible monument to the glories of French imperialism, French Napoleonic imperialism. They transferred all public services into the hands of the commune. Now, what that meant was that tasks still existed, but they could be performed by anybody, anywhere, and at a worker's salary. They suppressed the standing army and replaced it with the armed people. I mean, so all of these kinds of steps you can see as a really the way in which they were fiercely anti-state, and they were also highly indifferent to the nation. They really did not see themselves as the capital of France. You know, Gustave Courbet, who's probably the best-known communard, wrote to his mother in April that Paris had decided to no longer be the capital of France. It wanted to be something else, and it wanted to be really just a kind of a local commune within an international horizon of other communes.
And how did they organize themselves? And we should say that I should say that your book looks to that type of source material. How the communards, those people who I guess lived in that commune, how they represented what was going on contemporaneously.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, when I wrote the book, there's been an enormous amount of literature about the commune, and a lot of it is by sort of political theorists or even, you know, great political revolutionaries like Mao Zedong or Trotsky or people like that. And I decided to just sweep all that away and instead focus on what the communards themselves said about what they were doing. And there exists quite a lot of writing, because those people who were literate, who survived the massacre, all pretty much sat down immediately and wrote a book. So that was those were my sources. And what I looked at was, you know, some of the words they used, you know, like the word commune itself, you know, what did they mean by that? And it turns out that there's quite a lot of different resonances in a word like that. There's, you know, the desire to organize your own social life. There's a powerful demand for local autonomy. And that is something that is certainly one of the watchwords of the commune, and one that I think is, you know, very meaningful for us today when we look at attempts to kind of reorganize our lives in terms of certain notions of regional self-sufficiency, you know, or delinking from various kinds of transnational economic structures like the World Bank or anything like that. So it also meant, the word also harkened back to the most radically democratic aspect of the French Revolution. And mostly it just meant a kind of direct cooperation of all energies, all intelligences, all involved in every single detail of everyday life. And so it's, go on.
Well, I mean, from a practical standpoint, I mean, how did they organize themselves? I mean, it seems to me that, you know, in terms of some of the things that, you know, we're talking about, dismantling certain apparatus that becomes, okay, someone takes it upon themselves and they say this, and there's not necessarily a vested interest in maintaining it, but things like, secularizing or things like having broadening education, you know, schooling mm-hmm. for kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a proactive step in some respects, right? I mean, you need to have
sure.
like how did that organization take place? How was it that there were so many people on the same page?
Well, you know, because in the immediate years before the end of the empire, the city itself had gotten used to a certain kind of what we would perceive now as a really radical structure, which was neighborhood-based. So again, you have that emphasis on decentralization. So there were local communities in neighborhoods of workers who were already organized in that sense. The National Guard, for example, was organized that way. There was also the Parisian chapter of the International, you know, the workers' unions. They were organized in the same way. So you had the embryo, in a sense, of a revolutionary structure that was based on decentralization and direct participation. So people were used to that. And before the empire even ended, they were permitted, in a sense, by the emperor to begin to have reunions and meetings where they, discussed their own problems. They examined questions like women's salaries or how to get better work for women. All of these were, again, in this kind of local neighborhood kind of framework, so that when the commune was actually declared, it had already existed to a certain extent for a while in this structure, and so then when they turned to something like the schools, they had in mind, demands that had long existed within, you know, workers' political culture. But for something like what they called polytechnic education. And by that, and again, see, I find this to be an amazing idea for our own time. What they started to put into place was an educational system that was identical for boys and girls and for everyone regardless of class. And the idea was that a child should be educated not only in the way that we would think of education like, you know, math or theory or, you know, literature or whatever. Certainly that was necessary. But also that could only be done in conjunction with the learning of a manual trade. So in a way, you had it was a real attempt to pragmatically break down the opposition between manual and intellectual labor and to unite it into a set of skills that every child would have. So a child could, you know, think theoretically and at the same time, you know, make things, make shoes, for example. So you can see the sort of artisanal sensibility, but at the same time is the demand that a child not be destined to make shoes, you know, in the same way that your father did, and then you have to make shoes for the rest of your life. So you know, they did. School was at the center of the kind of attention to reorganizing bureaucracies that they performed.
And I should just remind people, we're talking about 1871. So these, you know, the implications of, and I guess that's, you know, one of the things that I think that I've read you talk about with your book is that you don't think there are necessarily lessons, or you don't believe that history can teach lessons. As people sort of extrapolate from this and see these as, I guess, inspirations in some way, I mean, just talk about that dynamic. You know, when we look at the way that the polytechnical education was conceived, and I guess to a certain extent may have been put in practice for at least a short period of time, how does that sort of translate to today?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I've long thought that, you know, people's demand that the past teach us lessons is a little bit off base, because I don't think that the past has a pedagogical relationship to us. What I try to do with something like thinking about a past event like the Commune is to see it as a laboratory, really, of political invention, from which we can't really extract any morals exactly or anything, but which can function as a kind of usable archive of resources for us. And this is a little different than the way that, you know, people usually look at things. You know, I mean, I can't tell you all of the backseat driving and what I call backseat driving, sort of the going back and saying, well, why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? Why weren't they better organized militarily? Why did they spend their time pulling down the Vendome Column, which was a symbolic act? Why didn't they seize the money from the bank? I mean, this is the general tenor of discourse in the literature about the Commune. And I really find that to be completely off base and ahistorical, really, you know. I mean, their world is not our world. And yet, if we profoundly understand that, then we can see the ways in which their world is, in fact, actually closer to our world than is, say, the world of our parents.
Tease that out for me, because, you know, when you're talking about the sort of the second guessing, you know, there was a lot of that with the Occupy movement in this country. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the dynamic is the same as much. I mean, it seems to me that there are certain things that, like, you know, two notions can't really always coexist with each other. If you're going to execute A, then you have to sort of relinquish some of the sort of the MOs of B, as it were. I mean, is that what you're getting? Explain to me that relationship between, you know, when people impose sort of their critique on what the Commune should have done, how it is that what they were doing was sort of similar to what we're doing today. What do you mean by that?
Well, two things. What I mean is that there's a lot of progressive thinking about emancipation that still operates as though we're all in agreement on a blueprint of ends that we want to attain, and as though those ends could be precisely determined, that they were the same in 1871, or that we could you know, sort of draw up a balance sheet or something and judge whether these objectives were achieved or not achieved according to our criteria in 2015. And I actually think that what that gesture is about the enormous pleasure that people take in granting themselves the ability to pronounce on what is possible, what is impossible, what's coming too soon, what's coming too late, what's outmoded, what's unrealistic at any given moment. I think people really enjoy doing that, but I don't think it's that helpful. Because I think that when you do something like that, when you adopt that position of judgment, what you lose is really any sense of the experimental dimension of politics or even of art.
Tell us what communal luxury is. This obviously is part of your title, but I mean, what does that mean?
I found that term in the manifesto that artists put together during the commune as they were sort of federalizing themselves into a union. And the sentence goes, we are working to regenerate ourselves and for future pleasure, future splendors, communal luxury, and the Universal Republic. So this is the last sentence of their manifesto. And what I think what the artists meant actually in that context was something like public beauty. In other words, they meant that, you know, towns and cities should be ameliorated in a kind of aesthetic way, that the public land, the public space should be aesthetically pleasing, or beyond that, that everyone has the right to live and work in a pleasing environment. Now, you could say that this is like a minor demand or some sort of a merely decorative demand, but if you think about it, it's actually a kind of profound restructuring of what we mean by art, if it's completely integrated into everyday life and not in museums, not in salons. This is something already quite enormous as a demand.
It also implies that you can't have people living in slums too, right?
Exactly. I mean, yeah, there's a completely economic and social dimension to it. It's that's integrated into the idea itself. It's really about overcoming the division between people who do and people who don't have the luxury to play with words or to play with images or to make art. So I think that in the long run, at its broadest, it's really pointing to how do we come up with another measure of social wealth of what a society means by luxury or what a society considers precious or another way of measuring that than the one given to us by the market.
I mean, in some ways, and I'm thinking about it in terms of, you know, sort of debates that we hear today. I mean, obviously, it's sort of like it harkens to this notion of the commons, but it mm-hmm. it seems to go beyond that too, where it says like it is not enough that there is no reason why even if you are not, you know. In the context of what we've been hearing lately in terms of our politics, you know, there's a lot of like, mm-hmm. you know, if you play hard by the rules, you have the opportunities to succeed, like, you know, and you too can be a Donald Trump, as it were, or you can be Hillary Clinton and make millions
right.
and this and that. But there's also sort of a question of why if I don't aspire to be a multimillionaire or a billionaire, can't I enjoy, going to a nice park or walking down a nice street. Why can't we have nice things for people who aren't society's winners, per se?
Yes. And even beyond that, because I think that it's the idea that everyone has a right to his or her share of the best. That's the excess that's in there that's kind of wonderful, is that it's about equality in abundance. Or, you know, and I think this is really valuable for us today as an idea when we look around and what we see is states redistributing wealth to the rich in the name of austerity. I mean, this is communal luxury is very much against the ideology of austerity. It's an idea of shared wealth that is really different from the kind of quantitative race to overproduction that we see, you know, in the overdeveloped world. So it's to me a kind of a timely idea. It's also
I would add, at a time where we have sort of you know, what we call poor shaming, where the idea of, like, mm-hmm. you know, you're not really poor, you have a television, let's say. I mean, you know, right. to make it sort of at its crassest level, how could you be poor? You have an air conditioner.
Exactly.
And the idea that, you know, if you are, you cannot really be suffering any deprivation if you're not, it's not 110 degrees in your one room apartment in the summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's that's the idea that the standard idea of luxury is that we have it because some people are slaves. You know, some people have to live that way in order to produce what William Morris called the swinish luxury of the rich.
And I want to also just, this is a slightly off topic, but it's more on topic of your last book. But I think the idea of how we look back on certain periods, I mean, I think this is the sort of the continuum between your books, is that, or at least this aspect of it, is how these events get reinterpreted in a way that, in some ways, I don't know if that's part of the agenda, but to sort of, I guess, de-emphasize the possibilities of the way that we organize ourselves. And I've heard you talk about the 1968 in Paris, the sort of the famous riots that took place there. And of course, there was a lot of sort of agitation going on around the world, and how over the decades, what took place during that time was reinterpreted. Will you just talk about that and sort of also why that is important in the context of the Paris Commune too?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in when and why a particular event re-enters into the present, you know, why it becomes visible again, and why it, you know, speaks to us in some way, when for decades an event can simply disappear, and it can be disappeared as well. And when I wrote my book about May 68, it was at a time when the event had been so thoroughly trivialized under the kinds of banalities that very similar, I mean, a similar thing, of course, happened in the United States, you know, with, say, the discourse of Nixon and Reagan, for example, that they produced around what the 60s were about. In France, it was a little different because, oh, well, maybe not so different. I mean, really what it had become reduced in people's minds and memories to a kind of free-spirited plea for sexual liberation and, you know, for girls being able to wear trousers, or for, you know, a kind of a purely sort of countercultural image had settled into place. And when I went back and looked at the films and the footage from the street fighting, I mean, I was astounded. The frontal political nature of this event had completely been erased. I mean, for instance, the word Vietnam was not ever mentioned when everything about the origins of 68 in France had to do with the American war in Vietnam. I mean, that's true pretty much everywhere, but particularly in France, you see this gradual erasure of the anti-state dimension, the anti-capitalist dimension, and the anti-imperialist dimension that was truly at the origins of the movement.
Yeah, I'm struck by that because I really do think that dynamic, it exists in the context of, I think it exists in the context of what the 60s were in this country. I think it exists in the context of someone like MLK and someone like Nelson Mandela, for that matter. I mean, there seems to be a water runs downhill. There seems to be this sort of natural reinterpretation or revisionist history that sort of flows to the least threatening reinterpretation of for the establishment. So Martin Luther King really was exclusively about civil rights in a very narrow sense that now no longer threatens the establishment. Right? We don't hear as much about his anti-poverty or his anti-imperialism. Or Nelson Mandela was he renounced violence? Well, no, he didn't, and so on. I mean, and it seems to me that we saw that almost immediately, even with like the Occupy movement, right? It was it was really more about people wanting to live in tents rather than a pushback to the sort of the established economic power of. I mean, that's fascinating, and I wonder what do you think accounts for that? I mean, that's a big question, but.
Well, you know, I mean, history belongs to the victors in some way, as many people have said, and there's an inevitable kind of whittling away, and the techniques of the whittling away of the political dimension of certain kinds of insurrections fascinate me, you know, and I think that, you know, the various kinds of tropes or I think banality is a really big weapon that is used by the let's say the ruling classes to just trivialize certain events like this. And you know, we can also talk about though moments when these events come back up, when there's a resurgence and they become very vivid and we can see them again. And that happened, for example, in a very funny way, with 68, vis-a-vis the Paris Commune, because, Lise Garé, the principal historian of the Commune and himself a communard, had written a book about the Commune. And, the leftist publisher, Maspero, republished it right in the end of 1967. And so that book suddenly was out and about. 68 happens, the largest general strike in French history. The entire country is shut down. What do people do? Well, one of the things they did was everyone rushed to the bookstores and tried to find books about the Paris Commune because... Mm. And you couldn't find a single one because they were all sold out. Now, partly this was also because there was time to read since no one was going to work at all. There's a natural moment that occurs when something new happens. And in the case of 68, you saw once again the metamorphosis of the city and of urban space into a kind of theater for strategic operations, and people became curious again. They thought, well, what did happen in the Commune? So, you know, there are moments when the dust of historical revisionism gets swept away and suddenly things become visible again.
Fascinating. Kristen Ross, author of Communal Luxury, Political Imaginary of the Paris Commune. Thank you so much for your time today. We will link to the book at majority.fm.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half, wherein we will trivialize in many respects, but also celebrate Donald Trump entering into the race. I got to say that when I heard Donald Trump was coming in, it must have been like what like a guy who sold like Cleveland Cavaliers T-shirts outside of you know, wherever the Cleveland Cavaliers play, when on the day he heard that LeBron was was re-signed, right? I mean, yeah, this is the equivalent. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Want to give the show a call? 646-257-3920. Want to enjoy some coffee? JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at MajorityReportKickback.com. Want to IM the show? Get our app. Just get our app anyways. MajorityApp.com for iOS and Android. What other show do you get to hear about a French communal movement in the 1870s and then, like, we just pivot on a dime to talk about one of the world's largest buffoons becoming the flag bearer for one of the world's most distorted political parties?
We can go pretty low ball pretty fast, bro.
We can go high. We can go low.
Whatever way you want. We could serve you. Scotty
B's working
at a bike shop, by the way.
I know. I heard that. Actually, I have more respect for him.
That's cool.
That's what I would do. Dude, if I had cashed out on being a board of director on a company that didn't even exist and they were paying me six figures, you can bet your butt I'd be going, first I go to the bike store, say, teach me how to make bikes. Then I go to the computer store and I'd say, hey, show me how to use that word processing program. How do I use Photoshop? Spend my whole time at the Genius Bar, at the Apple store, to find out how to use iTunes. All right, we got to take a break. We'll be back in just a second. 646-257-3920 is the number. Remember, it's your support that makes this show possible. Thank you, members. Be right back.